I've been looking at this koan, number 63 in the Book of Serenity. Zhao Zhou asks about death. Zhao Zhou asked Tozi, when someone who has undergone the great death then returns to life, how is it? Tozi said, he can't go by night. He should arrive in daylight. So this question of Zhao Zhou, when someone who has undergone the great death then returns, how is it? That's really asking about how do we live an enlightened life, a life of enlightenment. We all might have ideas about what enlightenment is. I've got a few of them that I'll throw out, but this isn't so much about how to define enlightenment, but I think a good place to start is Dogen's line about dropping body and mind. So literally releasing grasp on this fixed self of ideas and opinions and habits, dropping body and mind, can we release that grip a little bit? And I think we may have had the experience just in the period of Zazen last hour that our practice of Zazen is about loosening the grip on the self and opinions. You know, just as the thoughts emerge and we open the hand of thought, we let those thoughts drift through as Uchiyama says, like clouds through an empty sky. That's loosening our grip on these fixed ideas. And just for the breath, just for the 40 minutes, we're holding on to this separate self a little less tightly. So that's a clue to what it means to, you know, how do we live an enlightened life. It's a willingness to pay attention to the self as it constantly arises and separates the world into me and the rest of the world. So when we come to practice and we have the intention of leading an enlightened life, what we're saying is we've got a willingness to look inward and try to identify that self that keeps arising and separating us from the rest of the world. From the beginning, that bodhicitta mind that emerges, yeah, that's the mind that we get when we say, you know, I've always been interested in meditation. I wonder if there's a Zen center around. That's bodhicitta. That's the arising of the awakened mind, and with that comes this turning towards saving all beings. So from the very beginning, that first inkling that we might be interested in meditation and coming to the Zen Center and saving all beings, we see ourselves then not so much as a separate self, but as part of this network of interdependence, an interdependent community, and we vow to promote the well-being of that community. So all of these are clues from the very beginning that on how to lead the enlightened life when we have the great death. How do we return? How is it? So the koan goes on to say, you can't go by night. You have to arrive in the daylight. Light and dark are metaphors for the self and our vow of leading an enlightened life. Light is that discriminative mind, the picking and choosing mind, the mind that separates one thing from another, our likes and dislikes. The light, you know, the metaphor is that you see everything. And, you know, oh, I like this guy, I don't like this guy, I like this guy, I don't like this guy. You know, I like it when it's hot outside. I don't like these mornings that are 30 degrees at 5 in the morning when we come to the Zendo. So light is that metaphor for the discriminative mind, judging mind, the self that's dividing the world up, and the light is helping us see our likes and dislikes. And darkness is, it's not so intuitive, this use of light and dark, but you know, enlightened mind is about darkness, where, you know, in darkness, everything, you know, you can't tell one thing from another. It's all kind of blended together. Nothing is better than another thing. It's all kind of dark and hazy. You can't discriminate one thing from the other. We're all kind of existing together in that darkness. I mean, so it doesn't sound as gloomy, but that's the metaphor. So Tozi says about, you know, after the great death, when we've dropped off body and mind, when we've let go of the grasp of onto ourself just a little bit, how is it? He says, you can't go by night in the dark. It's about living fully in the world, in this bright, blissful, glowing place that we call home. It's not about anything special. This enlightened life of ours takes place in the broad daylight, not in a dark zendo for 40 minutes. It takes place right in the middle of our lives with our eyes wide open. But it's a little different. It's kind of like my experience of our Rohatsu Sesshin and our New Year's Eve celebration. It's about really being engaged in a different way with all the things we can see in our life. It's about this wholehearted engagement with the phenomena, with the things, with the people in our life. So that's another clue about how do we live this enlightened life. It's about really engaging fully, not with our likes and dislikes. I'm going to engage really well with the people that I like, and I'm going to go into my neutral corner with the people I don't like. It's about non-discriminating engagement, engaging with our heart, fully engaged. During the full moon ceremony, there's that one long section with the homages where we do prostration after prostration right in the middle. And, you know, no one's ever come out, you know, in our circle after that ceremony and said, "Gosh, I wish we didn't do so many bows." That's really a long section. I like the other sections, but I don't like all those bows. People come out and they've been bowing with the whole room. There are about 20, 25 of us. They've just been engaged with everybody in that room and with the chanting. You know, while we're bowing, we're also chanting. So, people usually have a smile on their face. This is me projecting, I'm sure, but at least no one's ever said to me, "I hate those bows. I hate that part." We're really engaged in that practice. And so you can be really engaged and you might, you know, not be doing bow after bow all the time, but you're really engaged in that. You might not be with people that are simpatico with you, that you like all the time, but you can be engaged with everyone, with your heart, that wholehearted engagement. So you have to arrive after you've dropped off body and mind with your intention to be enlightened. The enlightened life is being engaged. The story, the backstory to this question and answer. Tuzi lived in a hut in his native region. Zhao Zhou goes up to the hut. "Are you not the hermit of Tozi?" Tozi said, "Give me a coin for tea and salt." Zhao Zhu went ahead up the mountain. Tozi arrived later, carrying a jar of oil. Zhao Zhu said, "I have long heard of Tozi, but now that I've come here, I only see an old man selling oil." Tozi said, "You only see an old man selling oil. You don't recognize Tozi." Zhao Zhou said, "What is Tozi?" Tozi replied, holding up the jar of oil, "Oil, oil." So he was telling Zhao Zhou, your head was, maybe it was an admonishment. There's exclamation points after all. Zhao Zhou was looking around for Tozi and not so engaged with the man right in front of him with the oil can. And Tozi just said, you heard what he said. "You only see an old man selling oil. You don't recognize me. And who is this Tozi? Oil, oil." He encouraged Zhao Zhou to engage completely in the situation. The old man, the oil can, the salt. I've written here, we know from practice that when we engage with the world wholeheartedly, not stuck in a self with fixed ideas or opinions, we actually engage the individual. We're actually enlightened by individual phenomena of the world. Genjo Koan says this in that part, that famous part. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. That's the dropping body and mind. And to forget the self is to be enlightened by 10,000 things. So the study of Buddhism and the enlightened life is about a wholehearted engagement with this network of interdependence. So that's a little different than just, you know, I'm looking for 2Z up here on the mountain, and there he was right in front of him, disguised by the oil can. So it's a different, the enlightened life is a wholehearted engagement with the world in the full light. There's another teaching about our practice that first we identify the phenomena in the world. First there are the mountains and the waters, the mountains and the rivers. And then with practice there are no mountains and no rivers. That's kind of, we start practicing, we start learning, we start experiencing the emptiness of things. We start experiencing that network of interdependence, so that we're not identifying things, our likes and our dislikes, but engaging with our connection, our intimacy with the world. And then what develops is the mountains and rivers once again. But we've got that new relationship with them, that new connection, that new intimacy. This is sometimes the same three-part development is sometimes used to talk about the three turnings of the Dharma wheel, the three great eras of Buddhist practice over time, with the initial Theravadan time, really learning how to ethically engage with our Dharma family, and then with the emergence of Mahayana Buddhism, we learn the emptiness of all phenomena, and it points us towards that interconnected network, that interdependent network. And then with the third turning, we have that brilliant light of connecting with each and everything. And of course, it's not to be thought of in steps and stages, but just things we might notice as we practice along the way. How do we sustain this mind and heart of enlightenment, of engagement? I've talked before about this. One of the former Shusos of Green Gulch came down here several years ago and gave a talk. And he noticed what joy he felt when his young daughter was approaching him along the path, just seeing her. And he wondered why he couldn't have that same joy with everybody who he met along the way. And he made that a practice to try to engage his heart with the meeting of everybody he came across. I work with this person who's a little on the sour side, who I haven't quite found her sense of humor yet. She's been around forever at County Mental Health, a social worker. And she's done lots of clinical work, but pretty much for the last 20 years that I've been there, she's been in an administrative position. And on when I've got this stuck opinion of myself and her, I see her as, you know, when she's doing her job right, my job is harder. And I also have this very difficult client that I've had for 20 years who, when this client is really falling apart, she calls this administrator, her old social worker. And the client always tells me about it because she prefaces it by saying that she's complained about me to her. And mercifully, the administrator never tells me about it, so it's not like the administrator is shaking her fingers at me. So whatever my opinion is of the administrator, I just always have to remember that she knows exactly how to engage with her heart this other very difficult client in a way that I haven't figured out in 20 years. And I have to, and that can shine through, you know, when she's telling me new protocols and ways to do our work at County Mental Health. I have to see this luminous heart that knows exactly how to work with very difficult people. I have to really be aware of that. That's a part of it too. That's why she's still there at the county. She's now saving all beings in a very different way. It's really a luminous gift that she has. So that's when the Shuso from Green Gulch talked to me about that practice. It really connected with me. Is a way to really stay connected to your heart, to your engagement, to your intimacy. I think I've talked with a lot of people before. Another way is Reb Anderson has talked in his latest book on the third turning about the practice of receiving your life, of not feeling like you have to go out and meet your life and fix it along the way, but can you just meet your life? Can you receive it? Can you take it in? Can you have the mind and heart that says, this moment is the perfect expression of all of the causes and conditions from beginningless time? Can I see this moment? Can I receive this moment as perfect? That's been an engaging practice for me over the last few months, of just seeing this moment. My first reaction is to get kind of balled up, to get tied up in a knot of, you know, I've got to fix this. I'm not comfortable here. I don't like this. I like this. But to really, that self really emerges in difficult situations. And then, you know, can I sometimes summon the motivation to just receive that moment as the perfect expression of all of everything. No action. And if I do feel like I need to act, it's a very different mind that makes that action. It's the mind that's already said, this is perfect. This is perfect. The next action I do is going to be to engage with this perfect moment. And that's a very different mind than that would go out and say, you know, I don't like this. I'm uncomfortable. I've got to change this. I'm not so happy with this. I've got to change the environment. So that's an engaging practice for me. Can I just receive my life as the perfect expression of all time? Remembering light and dark again. I just listened to a Dharma talk online by a monk up in San Francisco, David Zimmerman. And he told the story of a French man who was blind, who was blinded, you know, after a while, after he could see. And the man was saying, when he's worried about not seeing, when he's worried about his safety, about getting around, not being able to see, he invariably falls and gets hurt and trips up. When he is engaged, when he's grateful that he's out in the middle of the world and engaged with the people and the environment around him, he feels that everything is illuminated, that he's not blind at all, that he's getting around just fine. He's seeing in a different way. And the way David was saying, it wasn't like I'm hearing better or I'm smelling better, I'm using my other senses. He really talked about the illumination that he experienced of the universe when he was engaged with his heart and grateful for being in the environment. A different kind of seeing, you know, from a fellow who, you know, did see before, so he knew about seeing. He really felt that he was experiencing light and getting around the world with that light. But it was about engagement, and it was about engaging with the heart and the body. Catherine would always advise us to, can you stay close to your body? Can you stay in your body? When you're experiencing in the world, can you be aware of what your body is feeling, of what your body is receiving? That was her lesson on receiving experience, receiving your life, and using your body to be receptive. I think in the same way, maybe Jean, you paraphrased Catherine's teaching there. I can remember you giving a talk a couple of years ago and talking about, you know, rather than your ears going out and grabbing the sound, can you just receive, can you wait till sound gets to your ears. Patience about being there's something about being content with that patience rather than going out and your ears hunting for some stimulus. So there's something about gratitude and patience and receptivity that all seems to go together here. As a way of staying engaged with your heart. And what's this enlightened life all about? Maybe we can stop here and talk about when we felt engaged, when we felt kind of the bliss of connectedness. I'm always accused of being a cheerleader for this practice. But I want to assure you that, you know, when I have to reframe my thinking about the administrator, it's not a bliss that I'm feeling, but I just have a different engagement. I feel more engaged. It's not that I'm just closer to her. I feel engaged with my work. I've got more of a inquisitiveness about, you know, I wonder how she does that. I wonder how she works with that other lady. It kind of makes me connected with everything about my work, not just, you know, I'm not just judging myself for my judging the administrator. I'm just curious. I'm just more curious about my life and my work, and right there I'm more involved in that network of interdependence. So maybe other people have had that experience.
I'm trying to make sense of this, Patrick, that I'm not really getting a strategy. Maybe I'm looking for a strategy. If it should ever occur that I have a drop body in mind, then I can't do whatever I would do in the darkness, it has to be in the light. And I'm dropping body and mind, but in the light, I need my body and mind. How do I reconcile this with giving the strategy, if you can?
Yeah, so it's, I think what the teacher in the koan is telling us is that, we recognize each other as enlightened beings. It's not about something special. It's about, you know, this ordinary mind is the mind of awakening. And we're going to be very engaged with the very stuff of our life. Our relationships, we're not going to have a totally different relationship. We're not going to have a totally different job. We're not going to have totally different house with this engaged mind. It's going to be our very life. but it's going to be kind of that brilliant engagement of intimacy and with you recognized all the people that were in the full moon ceremony on New Year's Eve. We could tell one person from another, but we were engaged with them in a very different way with our chanting and bowing, and we were connected, you know, with our hearts. So that's the light part. We're gonna. It's going to be a different kind of discrimination. The dropping body and mind is about is using the metaphor of darkness, where we're losing the discriminative features, our likes and dislikes. But with our enlightened life, we're going to be engaged fully in the light with all of the people and the things around us. Is that an answer? Is that, did I understand your question?
Yes.
Thank you. Chris.
This is a funny story. Somehow the way the mind gets caught by things, my monkey mind became a monkey. And so I really visualized this monkey jumping from branch to branch, from tree to tree, and it was
from thought to thought.
And at the same time, there was this part of me that was just really the dark part, just present, just seeing without separation. And somehow those two monkeys, they both looked alike, ended up on the same branch. And the monkey mind sat still. And they were both looking at my teacher who was giving the Dharma talk. And it was the most amazing experience. I did not call it dropping away body and mind, but there was this discriminative part of me that was holding still, mm-hmm. and it was watching together. Was the dark part, was the part that perceived things in a non-discriminatory way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very strange, and for a couple of days I could make it happen any time, and then it went away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's something about just being a little stiller, just stilling the mind a little bit, allows us to engage with things, and even we're even looking at our thoughts a little differently in Sesshin. So even that monkey mind that's jumping from thought to thought, we're noticing something different about our thoughts. We're engaged with our thoughts in a little different way. That's what I heard you saying. Thank you. I heard another talk on the computer by Reverend Mio Leahy up at the Hartford Street Zen Center on their website. He was talking about a variety of things, but one image that he brought up was how busy our lives are with work and relationships and, you know, our full schedules each day, that we can kind of become numb sometimes, numb to experience. And he talked about this practice as a way to engage. When there's so much numbing activity around us, what a pleasure it is to sit still, whether it's here in the Zendo, whether it's at our cushions at home, if we've got a corner at home, or even doing an occasional mindfulness practice, the simple ones like letting the phone ring three times and just being aware of our body. But this practice really can help us engage, can be more connected as the antidote to the kind of all the numbing activity that we can be distracted by, moves us through the day. And I thought that was a nice image of just being able to sit still. Marianne.
When we struck with the engagement of the heart, I hadn't really thought about that before. And in my own life, I feel like sometimes there's somewhat of a false engagement. I think I'm engaged with an open heart until somebody does something I really don't like. Or I'm uncomfortable and I kind of shut down. And I'm no longer really engaged because I'm so in my head about me and what I need. Mm-hmm. And then I think there have been other times when I have been engaged with the fact that I'm not getting what I want, but it's okay, and that kind of drops away, that I'm really much more engaged if I drop away, if I'm not in the way. Mm-hmm. And I can just sort of be with what's unfolding. But sometimes I think I'm engaged, and I'm really not, because I get slapped in the face with, something I don't like. But I also thought about this whole discussion about Zen and these stories are all so kind of indirect. And like there's this almost perfect expression of the feminine and the masculine or the light and the dark. It's like, nobody's very straight out about what anything means. You've got to sort of come at it through your heart because you'll never get there with your head. Mm-hmm. And I've never really got that until you talked about heart. I think that bodhicitta, I hadn't put those together somehow, they've been lying there right next to each other for so long. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So that's one of the questions I pose is how do we sustain, an enlightened life? Practice at the very least, a regular meditation practice at the very least keeps us close to our intention of saving all beings, of being fully engaged in this network of interdependence, of this intimacy. I always like to, the heart is our connecting organ. Interdependence isn't such a fun word, but we all know what it is to connect with the heart, and I think that's the only way we do connect, really. So at the very least, a sitting practice reminds us of that intention. I do get lost in my own practiced small self, at the very least, I'm just a few hours away from loosening that grip and, getting another chance to start the day, with a little looser grip, willing to connect more with the heart. So that's one of Suzuki's lessons about, can you just have a regular practice? And in our morning dedication, can we experience the tranquility of daily practice? Can we stay close to this practice and our intention of saving all beings, of connecting with the heart?
I think that I've really thought about sitting in meditation and being more in light, like enlightenment. But I think it's more about the dark and sort of emptiness that we can do. We sit, we're in the darkness, and then we go out into the world and we're in the light. It's somehow trying to hold both.
Yeah. And what is it in the merging of difference and unity? In the darkness there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and darkness there
are relative to one another, like
power and backwards. So they're not really separate places, but we carry non-discriminative, non-judging, receptive mind, into the world that is illuminated, the blind man in France would say it's illuminated with the heart, not so much with the sun, but with the heart. Thank you. Thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.